Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. We're excited to have with us this week Sister Camille D'Arienzo, who has an article in the current issue. Welcome, Sister Camille.
Thank you very much, Tim.
I should note that Sister Camille is also, in addition to being an occasional contributor to America, is a regular contributor to 1010 Wins as their Catholic commentator. And those appear at Sunday nights, I believe?
At three times on Sunday, 8:37 in the morning, 3:37 in the afternoon, and 11:37 at night.
So those of you in New York, I'm sure, have heard Sister Camille before and can hear her in the future every Sunday. Well, we're going to talk about this article, which you've written, Faith in Focus, as we call it, for the current issue, which is about the whole kind of difficult issue of dealing with the issue of forgiveness in relation to sexual abuse. You've written about this issue before. How did you first kind of get interested in this subject?
I think my very first of all, the whole business of sexual abuse by clergy was an absolute astonishing revelation to me. It seems in hindsight that having been so much a part of the church and so close to priests for so many years, that I would have been taken so off guard. It's kind of perplexing to me. But the reality is that I knew a priest, didn't know him very well personally, but knew him by reputation as being a superb chaplain in a Catholic high school for 18 years. Absolutely the best that you could ever want, present to a very large population of school girls, their families, their faculty, always on call, always dependable, always a great resource, compatible, just a wonderful person. And he was accused of sexual abuse and immediately taken out of school. The abuse apparently had happened more than 18 years prior and was real. But to this day, that particular priest is very much a pariah, has no full-time job. I don't know what his connections are. But while certainly I feel tremendous uneasiness and distress that any child would ever be abused by anyone, especially by someone who was in a position of trust, I cannot help looking at this man, perhaps 6-7 years later, whose life and ministry are ended. It is kind of a spiritual death sentence to ministry. I'm not sure of what could or should be done, but I feel a tremendous sadness when I think about this individual who probably doesn't have a clue that he remains on my radar because there were no bonds. But he became typical of so many who somewhere along the line did a terrible thing and apparently repented, reformed, and many years later were kind of arrested, whether or not prison is part of it, and it is for some, and whatever gifts they had are no longer in use, and they seem to be outside any knowledgeable way of reintegrating or bringing them back into the fold or encouraging that those who hold these people, these abusers in contempt, would have any obligation to rethink their attitudes toward this particular kind of sin or sickness, whatever it happens to be.
Now, this is 2008, the sex abuse crisis scandal was revealed in 2002, so we're 6 years removed, but it seems like there's a lot of raw anger still out there. You begin your article by describing an event in a parish in Long Island with a group called Opus Bono that represents priests that have been accused of abuse, and as you describe it, this individual, this representative from the group, kind of listed how a number of priests had been wrongly accused and that they deserve to be defended and deserve some kind of representation. But as you describe it, a lot of people in the crowd did not take to this message. They were still very angry, which, as you point out, shows that this issue is still very raw.
I'd have to say, first of all, I just want to clarify that a representative from that organization, Opus Boni, was a speaker. But the group itself was called by very wonderful priests who are in good standing, who work with the poor, who are respected in the Rockville Center Diocese, who have as much concern, maybe more concern, for those who have been abused as for those who are accused, guilty or innocent. So the idea was to summon people who shared their concerns for those two ends of that spectrum. And I was there simply out of interest to see where it would go and what wisdom we could gather in an environment of faith and conversation. And I was terribly disappointed.
Yes, that's, you sort of use as an example of how, you know, far we still have to go in this mm-hmm. issue. What you do is use a lot of ideas that are fairly common, in, for example, in the therapeutic or psychological community, the need to forgive, because forgiveness can bring healing not only to the person who needs forgiveness, but also the person who is granting the forgiveness. Because, as you say, it can become a poison, which can really, really infect your life. And it's important to let go of that. So that's an interesting way of putting it, that it's not always for the other person, but for yourself as well.
And also for the people who are closest to you, those family members, including parents and children and other siblings, whose sympathy is certainly with the person who has been abused, and rightly so. But sometimes the anger becomes a blanket that overwhelms people who love the one who has been abused to a degree that, like the fire of joy and normalcy, becomes overwhelmed or snuffed out. I think that's a possible consequence, and I'm sure it exists in some cases.
Well, you write about, for example, what Father Richard McBrien has said about murder, is that a murderer who repents and confesses may be restored to the state of grace, although maybe not to freedom, and that each murder case is judged in terms of mitigating factors. And it seems sensible to apply these same standards to people accused of sexual abuse, but this is such a heated issue that people seem to want to apply a whole different set of standards to it.
Well, that's understandable, because the victim is a child, and anyone who does not have profound sympathy and who does not react with understandable rage to that kind of violation is certainly deficient in what is normal reaction. I think that the light of faith calls us to something that is beyond what is normal and natural, into a realm of the spiritual, into a realm of trying to connect with the mind of God that wishes salvation, redemption, correction, reconciliation for all members of the human family. It's not easy. It is so hard to talk about it, because you know that the very words you use, meaning to comfort and console, can further ignite and aggravate. But dare we forever remain silent about something so central to our faith, that forgiveness has been won for us by the redemptive sacrifice of Jesus Christ? Do we say that there is someone or some class of people who are forever excluded from the mercy of God? And whose God is that?
Yeah, this is, I should point out, is not just an issue, obviously, with the case of the sexual abuse crisis in the church, but it's in the news recently when there was a state that wanted to put to death somebody who was convicted of child abuse. And the Supreme Court said that actually we cannot apply this standard to cases where somebody has not taken a life. I think it's an example that, you know, this issue is not just in the case of abuse by Catholic clergy, but across the board is something that people have very strong feelings about.
Mm-hmm. I think so much of my learning has been from interaction with families of murder victims. Now, I think, for instance, of Bud Welsh, whose daughter Julie, young 20-something, 23, I think, was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing. And if you remember, Bud Welsh has become quite a public speaker and a prominent opponent of capital punishment. But he said his first instinct about Timothy McVeigh was to find him and to kill him himself. That was the natural urge. And he himself, Bud Welsh, was so filled with rage that he could think of nothing else other than how to punish this person who had taken his beautiful daughter's life. And then somewhere in this misery, he remembered a conversation that they had when he was driving her to work one day, in which she denounced the state of Texas for its execution of murder victims, of murderers, excuse me. And it was, he could hear his daughter's voice saying, this is not the right thing to do. And in that moment of grace, he found the weight of hatred replaced by a desire for some sort of ability to extend forgiveness, reconciliation. And we know that he went to see Timothy McVeigh's father, upstate New York. And in a meeting in this man's kitchen, I think there was a divorce in the family, so the man lived alone. And he was a Catholic who volunteered in the church and had a farm and was not a very talkative person. But those two men sat in a kitchen over a cup of tea, and both had lost a child. And then there are the Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation have a tremendous register of people whose children have been murdered and who have gone from anger to forgiveness. Marietta J. Galane, whose 7-year-old daughter was taken from her tent while they slept, was raped and murdered, and who wanted nothing more than to see the perpetrator, a Vietnam veteran, and who reached out to him. Now, that man committed suicide before he could be brought to justice, but people have found a way to turn, what St. Francis of Assisi asked us to do, Lord, where there is hatred, let me so love.
Yes, as you point out, the notion you bring up here of forgiveness and the power of forgiveness has been shown to be so powerful in so many different circumstances. So it only makes sense to bring it to bear on this delicate issue of sexual abuse by priests.
And yet, this is not something that can be imposed, and I'm very clear mm-hmm. about that. That it is they say faith is a gift, and I think the ability to forgive is a grace. But those who believe in the redemptive power of forgiveness have some obligation to let that light shine somewhere without being intrusive or insistent or imposing. But to keep it forever under the bushel basket does not seem to be what God is calling us to do when we are to act courageously in behalf of salvation.
Now, you've written about this in the pages of America. You believe this is an important issue. How else as Catholics can we kind of broach this very delicate topic? Writing about it, speaking about it, what other ways are there?
I think praying about it, first of all. I think that, before we speak, we had better pray, because our words can contribute to the misery that is already there. It's almost impossible for them not to do that, because it is still opening and massaging a wound, a pain that perhaps for some will never go away. I think to pray for all those who have been involved, for those who have been abused and for those who have been accused, whether guilty or innocent, I think prayer is extremely important. Prayer also settles the prayer into a more reasonable way of approaching human misery.
Now, one of the highlights of your piece is that you bring the wisdom of a lot of writers, poets, to bear on this. And one I think is particularly instructive is Rabbi Abraham Heschel. And you say that it is, in these cases, it's important to consider all sides of destructive relationships. But we also must include God's perspective of it as well. And God's, the forgiveness that he brings. And that's something that we might often forget about in mediating these things, is that perspective needs to be there as well.
I think it's also, because I loved the late Rabbi Abraham Heschel, I remember thinking so many times that Thich Nhat Hanh would say, when there is a matter of disagreement, you must go from one side to listen to the grievance and then to the other side and somehow, create this bridge. But Heschel, of course, said there's another angle. You have to look at it from God's perspective. And that's what we're called to do. And I think that is part of what St. Teresa of Avila meant when she gave that wonderful meditation that Christ says to us, I have no other hands but yours, no other eyes but yours. That whole thing, God wants to work through us. Can we allow this to happen? And can we allow it to happen with faith and delicacy and gentleness and humility? There is a kind of, in me, there is a great fear of any arrogance in projecting that this is the only answer and everyone must abide by it. I don't believe that at all. I can only hope that for those for whom God has given the grace and for those who are ready, the things that I suggest may be seeds that will produce some healing fruitfulness for the people who hurt so badly.
I think one of the challenges that you face in trying to bring this topic up and kind of bring healing is that there are groups that represent both sides, as you described in the beginning of your piece, who have deeply held beliefs about what went wrong and why it went wrong. Bringing these sides together would seem to be one of the most difficult issues. You know, victims who are legitimately angry at the church, yet how do you bring the issue of forgiveness up to people who, as you say, have been so hurt? And yet you also have on the other side priests who feel like they've been wrongly accused. Maybe there's a need for a third group or some sort of somebody to bring these two sides together.
Well, I certainly have been grateful for Pope Benedict's expressions of dismay and request for forgiveness for those who have been abused by clergy over the years. He did it in this country. He certainly did it in Australia at the World Youth Day. He's done it so very prominently. But I have not heard, now maybe it's because my ear has not been attuned, but I have not heard from anyone in any position in the church that there is a responsibility to encourage forgiveness at any level. Maybe it's being said, and I would love to be able to read it somewhere. The closest that I ever got to it was from the head of a religious community, a male head of a religious community, way back in the beginning of this horror saga within the church, when I met with him and said, what are we to do facing this terrible disgrace, this terrible agony, this anguish that we are all feeling because we love the church and we love God's people and we all feel betrayed? He said, the only thing I know is that anyone who denies another a place at the table is not worthy of it himself.
Maybe we'll end on those words, and I think there's an important message. Again, you can read it in our current issue. Sister Camille D'Arienzo, a member of the Sisters of Mercy, thank you again for joining us, and I hope you can come back again soon.
Thank you, Tim.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Sister Camille's article, Mercy Toward Our Fathers, is in the August 18th through 25th issue. Now, this is our last bi-weekly podcast. We'll be back to our weekly schedule in a couple weeks. And you can download our podcast where they'll be posted either Wednesday or Thursday afternoons. I want to thank Bill McGarvey again, who provided music for this week's show. You can learn about him and his new album at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.